From Atlanta, Georgia, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today on the campus of Clark Atlanta University, we are about to make history for our show. This is our first ever broadcast in front of a live audience. On today's town hall, we'll talk about the youth vote and how people in their teens and 20s are showing up at the polls in record numbers. To kick things off, we've got William Jelani Cobb. He is an associate professor of history at Spelman College. He's also a contributing writer for Essence magazine and the author of The Devil and Dave Chappelle and other essays. Also with us is Lisa Border. She is the president of the Atlanta City Council. Jelani and President Borders, welcome to the show. So I have to say I'm extremely excited. It's fabulous to be doing something in a live format. And Jelani, let me start with you. Many of the people in this audience are students, and we have seen first-time voters and new voters and young voters, and in particularly young black voters, come out in record numbers for the primaries. Do you think that interest is going to translate into any kind of a larger movement that engages people in the civic life of America, not just for elections, but on a grassroots level?
I absolutely think that we will see some kind of effect of this 2008 presidential election. One of the things that happened in 1984 and 1988 with Jesse Jackson's historic presidential campaigns was that he did not win the nomination, but the people that he energized and the people he brought into the political process were responsible for a whole new set of black elected officials being swept into office nationwide. And so I think we have a very good chance of seeing that same kind of dynamic repeat itself, and also seeing, hopefully, a broader spectrum of voices in determining kind of where our national politics go and what we emphasize, what we pay attention to.
President Borders, most of us will not hold any kind of elected office. And from your perspective, as someone who has gone from being a citizen to a public servant, what do you want to see from citizens? And what I mean by that is a lot of us complain about politics, but we see it as, you know, maybe you vote every 2 years, even once a year, but still, you have this kind of passing engagement with politics. If you could ask something of your constituents or of younger voters, what would you ask?
Thank you, Farai, and it's great to have you here in Atlanta. Thanks for being with us. If I had to ask my constituents to do anything, it would be to have a sustained sense of involvement, not only in the city of Atlanta, but all across the country. I think in election cycle times, we tend to be extremely focused on particular issues that present themselves. But the truth of the matter is we have issues that present themselves in the city of Atlanta and all across the country every day. Each and every one of us is a leader. My definition is passion turned into action. So I would suggest that each and every one of us has an opportunity to participate every single day, not just during regular election cycles.
Now, Jelani, you actually are playing a couple different roles. I saw that you're running for a delegate position. What is it? I mean, I think we've learned a lot. There are words being thrown out like superdelegate and, you know, earned delegates. What does it mean for you to run to be a delegate?
Well, I'll say that I'm running for a delegate position in the Democratic Party in the 5th District in Atlanta, in Georgia. And the reason that I decided to run was simply because I, like very many of the people who you mentioned, have been quite energized by the process as we've seen. And also, one of the, I guess, ancillary good effects of this election is that we're seeing people become much more knowledgeable about the process. So for the first time, I'm having conversations with people who actually understand what the Electoral College is and understand what the delegates do. The reason that I decided to run was that there was a lot of questioning in terms of how committed people would be to the candidates that they are pledged to. And so I said, well, I'm really concerned about this issue, and I think I'll take President Borders' her idea to heart that passion and action will be combined, and I'll run to make sure that I can represent this issue myself.
Now, President Borders, there's one thing to plug into national politics where you get to see people on TV all the time making the news, but people don't necessarily know as much about what goes on in the city level with the government, education. How can you connect people to the issues, and also frame it in terms of university students, because university students can vote either in the districts they come from, if they come from out of the city or the state, or they can vote where they live. Do you have an opinion on how people should vote?
No, I don't necessarily. I just want everybody to vote. That is the main thing, is to have everyone participating, whether it's in this city or whether it's in their home city. My own son just recently moved to California, and I encouraged him to change his voting precinct and place so that he would be engaged in the process actively there in California. But I would say, overall, what we need to do is make sure that folks understand you can do more than just vote in a cycle. If you are working every day in your community, there are things you can do. And the way I always talk about it, there's four things, four W's: work, witness, wealth, and wisdom. You can add each one of those to your community.
I'm going to stick with you for a second, because your current mayor, Mayor Franklin, was named one of the best mayors in America, and you are possibly going to throw your hat into the ring when she leaves?
I have thrown my hat into the ring.
You've thrown your hat into the ring. What is the urban agenda, particularly for Black communities, in your mind? What has to be dealt with, not just in this city, but across the cities that house so many Black families?
I think from a tactical perspective, we've got affordable housing, we've got poverty, we've got health care, we've got economic improvement in our communities. But from a more comprehensive perspective, I think what we are looking at is having a quality of life that everyone deserves and an opportunity for everyone to be able to support themselves and their families. Our communities are devolving as well as Atlanta is doing. There is probably a 25% poverty rate here. That is absolutely unacceptable. I was raised in a community here in Atlanta that supported its residents. It takes more than a village. It takes all of us recognizing that we are inextricably linked. And so that means raising all boats at the same time. So it is unacceptable to me to have folks in poverty in the city of Atlanta. So my position would be, it's a situation of inclusion, that we should have everybody eating, reading, healthy, and working.
Jelani, there's a situation, a shameful situation, where we just did a story on how only 25% of students eventually graduate high school in Detroit. And the statistics are staggering. You are at Spelman, which is one of these places where people funnel up to the top of the educational system. But what do you think needs to be done overall in terms of education, and what role should government play in that?
Well, I think that I'm glad you asked that question. I think that we need nothing short of a Marshall Plan for our American educational system. For those of us who are familiar, we remember that the Marshall Plan came after World War II and was a comprehensive attempt to rebuild the European economies that had been destroyed by the war. We're looking at a country that has to compete globally, and we are decreasingly capable of doing so, especially when it comes to math and science. And so the kind of standing thing is that if you were a talented mathematician or a science student in India 30 years ago or 40 years ago, the first thing that you applied for was a visa to come to the United States. If you are that same student in 2008, you are thinking of staying exactly where you are. And so this is something that touches not only Black communities, it will touch us most severely, if history is any indicator, but it's something that touches the broader American society as well. And we have to look at these things as American problems. They will not be isolated. They will not be Jim Crowed into Black communities. They simply touch each and every one of us. And I think we need to have a massive investment in improving the infrastructure, the actual facilities where learning takes place, and the outcomes that we hope to get from these institutions.
And President Borders, what about these tough economic times? You know, there's a saying that when white America gets a cold, Black America gets the flu. And there's going to be, there already are massive job losses. How do you tell people to keep the faith through these times? And what kind of advice, not necessarily just political advice, would you give to your constituents?
When we are talking about Black America getting the flu, and I do believe we are in a recession, everyone says we think we're in a recession, but I believe we are absolutely in a recession. But what I would tell people is they've got to retrench. We've got to pull together. It starts with educating our children, quite frankly. The public school systems here in Atlanta have made vast improvements, but making sure that every child can read, making sure that every child is fully prepared, helps us in the longer term. In the shorter term, we've got to redeploy our skills, pull in new ways of doing business. We understand that jobs are going overseas, that economic times are difficult, but it's going to take more than just learning new skills. It takes everybody working together.
Jelani, quickly, what do folks need to do?
Well, start by voting. People need to come out and vote. And in a very real sense, it doesn't necessarily matter who you vote for as long as your voice is registered in the process. Now, of course, I have my own preferences, but that's for another subject for another day. But I think that we need to vote. We need to make sure that we hold people accountable once we have voted. And I think that we each need to find our own little niche where we can contribute and give back to our communities. And in that small kind of way, it may seem abstract and vague, but I think that big change can come out of that.
Well, President Borders and Jelani, I want to thank you so much for kicking off our show. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, Lisa Borders is the president of the Atlanta City Council and CEO of the consulting firm, the LMB Group. She plans on running for mayor of Atlanta in 2009. And William Jelani Cobb is an associate professor of history at Spelman College. Both are here with me at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. And you can watch highlights of today's town hall meeting at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Welcome back to News and Notes' first ever live town hall show. I'm Farai Chidea. We are broadcasting from the campus of Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. And today we're talking about election 2008 and the youth vote. Hundreds of thousands of new voters registered to take part in this year's presidential primaries. But how are organizers going to make sure they come out in the fall? With me, William Jelani Cobb, Associate Professor of History at Spelman College. Amber Scott, a senior at Spelman College and the president of the school's NAACP chapter. And Rob Biko Baker, Executive Director of the League of Young Voters in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start out with this national election. Political analysts say Obama's campaign has mobilized a lot of young student voters this election. Now, I'm going to go straight to you, Amber. What are students doing in terms of, you know, on your campus? Are people advocating for specific candidates? Are people doing get out the vote? What do you see on Spelman's campus?
On Spelman's campus, we're seeing a lot of people rallying for different candidates. So we have students for Hillary, we have students for Obama, and being president of NAACP chapter at Spelman has allowed us to, through each of our events, whether we're working in education, healthcare, or economic aspects of the African American community, what we've been able to do is translate that into the importance of voting. So whether we're talking about education, we're always able to tie in the importance of voting and getting your voice heard, but then again, that's just the beginning.
Biko, your organization, the League, really does continuous grassroots work. Why don't you just quickly describe what you guys do?
Yeah, we do voter education and mobilization 365 days of the year. We've been around since 2004 and have been really working in impoverished communities that work with low-income youth and non-college communities.
When it comes down to it, do you find a lot of people, the word bitter was recently used by Barack Obama, and he got a lot of heat for that, but I would say that some young black voters are bitter, tired of seeing people come in and out of office and tired of seeing that there isn't much change on the ground. How do you deal with someone who might say, you know, we had Talib Kweli come on our show, you know, hip-hop artist and community organizer, but he said he doesn't vote on principle?
I mean, he's just uneducated. I mean, the truth of the matter is, you know, rich white folks wouldn't give billions of dollars, you know, through these election cycles for us to go out to the polls or to try to stop us from going to the polls. And truth of the matter is, voting is just a demonstration of our power. We got to keep pushing and keep fighting. And if we're not doing that, then we're just throwing our vote away. But come January, come to you know, October, if we're fighting and pushing in 2009, we're gonna have some power at the table.
Before I come to you, Jelani, I'm going to go to the audience. We've got some folks who have questions. I would ask you to step up to the mic and give us your name and where you're from and your question.
Okay. Dr. Mike Weaver, Farai Chidea, pleasure meeting you.
Thank you
for coming to Atlanta. And I really wanted to address this question to President Borders, but what we will do is address it to William Jelani Cobb, Dr. Cobb there at Spelman. We know that with the president, with the mayoral election that's going on here in Atlanta, word is I'm a City of Atlanta resident. I don't live in the suburbs. I live about 5 blocks away from campus, right near campus. However, we know that we're hearing that about 16 blacks are going to be running for mayor of Atlanta. We've heard that there's definitely one white female who's running for mayor. So there are those who are opining, in essence, that the next mayor of Atlanta will be white and more than likely female. What do you think with this possible battleground of 16 candidates, black candidates for mayor versus, say, this one white candidate, and a white candidate, say, becomes mayor of Atlanta? What do you think that's going to do to the political base of Atlanta? Thank you.
So it sounds like it's a question of divide and conquer. You know, that's the question that's coming. What do you think about that?
First, I would like to say about Dr. Weaver's work that I'm very much, and very many of us, appreciate the work that you've done. He has been a consistent voice, making sure that the people who have been dispersed throughout the country because of hurricanes Katrina and Rita, that they are not forgotten and have been on the ground. And so I want to say that I appreciate your work in that regard. I'm not the best person to talk about the politics of the mayoral race, but what I will say is that I believe that the population, the black population of Atlanta, has declined by about 13%, somewhere around there, in the last 10 to 12 years, largely because of gentrification and the changing demographics that come along with that. What I'm not prepared to say that I think the next mayor will be a white female, but I will say that I think whoever comes into office will probably be confronted by the same kinds of political coalition building that we've seen on a national level that Barack Obama has had to do, simply saying that these two populations people will have to have supporters in each of these populations in order to get anything done.
We were able to bring President Borders back to the mic since she was also referencing the question. What do you think?
Thank you, Farai. It is true that the demographics are shifting in Atlanta, but my own candidacy in 2004, where we had black and white candidates, demonstrated that people really are interested in competence over color and results over race. And so what I would say is that whoever comes to be elected, and I'm going to claim it right here, right now, that it will be me, that we will be faced with economic challenges in the city. And that is not just for the African-American community. That will be for every community across the city.
Let's go to this question of how people get into the system. And I don't mean the prison system. I don't mean the educational system. I mean the political system. Biko, are you preparing people not only to vote, but also to take leadership positions? And if so, how?
I mean, that's the only way we're going to make change in this country. The truth of the matter is that there's been a significant gap that the author Bakari Katwana talks about from the civil rights and hip-hop generation that's sort of been created by some structural problems in our community. And a lot of us don't know how to practice democracy. A lot of us don't have institutions in our community. We don't go to the churches at the same rate as our parents. And we're living in a generation where we don't have hand-to-hand mentorship. And it's been up to us and our organization to stay in the hood, stay over there in Milwaukee, over the Rhine in Cincinnati, got some people from Milwaukee in here right now, and really give them the opportunity to see how democracy works.
Amber, how did you grow up in terms of political and news education? Because one of the things that some studies have found is that people who are most likely to vote have parents who voted and who taught them that this was important. How did your family teach you?
That's definitely one of the ways how I became involved in the political process. I usually went to the polls with my dad. He always asked if I could go in the little booth, so I was able to see, and he made sure to let me know at a young age that, you know, this is my right. People fought for me to have this right to vote. And so once I was able to, after my 18th birthday, I had the chance to mail my absentee ballot. I was very excited. I have a picture of me holding it at the mailbox. So definitely something that was ingrained in me at a young age. And I think that incorporating that within the educational system, just showing students how to become a productive citizen, so voting, writing letters to your elected officials, or perhaps even running for an elected position, are just some of the ways that students can become involved in the political process.
I want to make sure that folks just tuning in from around the country know that we're talking about the youth vote. You are listening to NPR's News and Notes in Atlanta. I am Farai Chidea. We've got with us Amber Scott, a senior at Spelman College and the president of the school's chapter of the NAACP, Rob Biko Baker, executive director of the League of Young Voters, and William Jelani Cobb, associate professor of history at Spelman College. And Jelani, the work that you do stretches way back in history, not just now, but you know, a century or so back in terms of African-American political engagement. What have we gained? What has gone well in that time?
Well, one of the things that I think that we have to be mindful of, and I want to kind of reemphasize Biko's point, when people say that voting doesn't change anything, I say that if that was the case, people would not have spent the enormous energy and resources that they did devote to keeping us from doing it. So that's where we start. Initially, when we see black voting participation in the South after the Civil War, one of the things that we have to confront is that after the Civil War, the foundations of public education in the American South largely came as a result of Republican and specifically African-American voters. That was one of the major impacts of black voters, because prior to the Civil War, the South's public educational infrastructure was much farther behind that of the North than it ultimately wound up being. When we look at more specifically, more recently, the behaviors, the political behaviors of the Democratic Party switched from being really the party of Southern segregationists and people who wanted to keep Jim Crow alive, to being the party that signed the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 1965 and 1964, respectively. That was done on the strength of the black vote. When black people began migrating from the South to the North, northern cities were Democratic strongholds for a long time, and as long as cities were dominated by white ethnic and immigrant votes, they didn't have to pay any attention to black people. But once black people began moving into cities, the Democratic Party was forced to confront the possibility of either losing their base in these major cities or changing their agenda. And so when we look, we can go example after example after example, but clearly the black vote is not the only means, it's not the only tool in the box, but it is a key and an essential one.
I want to go to the audience for another question. And again, I would ask you to get close to the mic, give us your name and where you're from.
How you doing? My name is Raheem Manning. I'm a freshman here at Clark Atlanta University, and I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I think this is a good event that we're having here, and I think it raises a lot of issues. I heard the panel discuss several different things that I feel affect me as a young African-American male. One thing is, you know, the soaring numbers at the polls for my generation and those of my demographic. Just a comment on that before I pose my question. I believe that this election has been large in my community and my generation because there's a lot of issues out now that affect the young black community on a local level and as well as a national level. And I think it's a great thing that you have President Borders here to speak about the local level thing. On a national level, you have events like Hurricane Katrina. You have events like Gen 6 that really mobilized, the black community and the black youth. And I believe that, you know, we're ready to see change and things like that not continue. For President Borders, on a local level, we have laws that affect the black community, such as the ban on saggy pants, which has been a large thing that we've been talking about here at Clark Atlanta.
We're going to talk about that later this week, but why don't you toss out a question?
The question is, do you agree with the fact that this election really affects the black youth, and do you agree that the black youth are tired of seeing people in offices that don't have our interests at hand?
I think one of the issues is when we talk about the young vote, a lot of times folks aren't really highlighting that that's really college voters. One in four college voters turned out in Super Tuesday. But 1 in 14 non-college voters, which really means poor people, people of color, didn't show up. And that's because folks aren't talking about issues. You're from Philly. Philly is off the chain. Drama's from Philly. It's off the chain in terms of murder. You know what I'm saying? People are not connecting the fact that there are these huge structural problems in our communities to the fact that young people are dying every day in the street. And until we start to talk about that, last year at this time, Barack Obama was in Milwaukee the day of Virginia Tech, April 16th. And he gave a passionate speech about violence. He hasn't come back to that speech very much. And us as young people of color need to hold him accountable and other people accountable to that message, because otherwise there is no reason for us to vote if they're not talking about schools, if they're not talking about violence, if they're not talking about jobs, because we're getting our butt kicked right now.
Amber, you are with the NAACP, and the NAACP has been criticized for not having enough people like you. You know, the average age is at least in the 50s of members, if not higher. So do you believe that a civil rights agenda or a African-American agenda is still something that you can promote through specific organizations like the NAACP? And how do you think the NAACP is doing on youth issues?
I'll start with tackling the African-American agenda. I think that organizations such as the NAACP, I think the agenda should be for people in general. And what we advocate for is more so people impoverished positions. And to the question about the programs of the NAACP, I think we do a pretty good job of, you know, registering people to vote, mobilizing them, and educating them about the different process. What we could do, something that we could work on, is definitely reaching more people through community dorm or community walkthroughs and things of that nature.
Jelani, from your perspective, is politics evolving so that African-American specific outreach will fade out and it'll be this kind of universal brown people of color? Or is there still a room and a role, not just in this election, but in future elections, for specifically African-American outreach?
Mm-hmm. At the risk of sounding very political, I'll say both. The reason I say that is that we will have issues that are specific to the African-American community that continue to plague and beleaguer us, but we also have to be able to look at those issues within a broader context. And so we're entering now a new era of coalition politics, and I think that that's what's really exciting, where people will have a coalition not based upon philanthropic goodwill, but based upon shared common interest and shared common concerns.
Bika?
I mean, I think the truth of the matter is black folks don't like to talk about class. And the truth of the matter is, as long as people are exploited because of their color, they will have to deal with the fact that they're black. At the same time, I think one of the issues is that there's been so much social mobility since the civil rights generation that when I walk on campus here, I feel it out of place. You know, I mean, I'm a blue-collar dude. You know, I wanted to go to Morehouse, couldn't afford it. And I think until our community starts to bridge those divides of race and class, we're going to keep having some problems. And, you know, you can look at a city like Detroit, you can look at a city like Philly, you can look at a city like Atlanta and see that this city hasn't all the way dealt with its racial and class issues.
All right, well, I have to go to a break, but we're going to take more questions after that break, and I want to thank you three for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with William Jelani Cobb, Associate Professor of History at Spelman College, Amber Scott, a senior at Spelman College and the president of the school's NAACP chapter, and Rob Biko Baker, the executive director for the League of Young Voters in Brooklyn, New York. They were all with me at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. And we invite you to weigh in on these topics on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Getting young, first-time voters to show up to the polls on Election Day can be tricky. As we heard earlier in the show, youth vote organizers use everything from technology to music to mobilize this voting bloc. Now we're going to focus on how hip-hop is firing up some voters this election. We're speaking with Robert Biko Baker, the executive director of the League of Young Voters, Sonia Murray, a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and DJ Drama, an Atlanta-based recording artist and DJ. Welcome to y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, DJ Drama. This may be a tough one, but I'm having a week where I'm asking folks tough questions. You, one of the folks that you have collaborated with is T.I.
Uh-huh.
He recently admitted that he was guilty of some gun charges. He was recently tossed from a sponsorship deal, but he is now on Sunday at Temple University in Pennsylvania, in Philly, headlining a hip-hop voter registration event. Do you think that it's fair for artists who are having legal problems or who may not meet X, Y, or Z standards to be the people who are out in front on this? How do you feel about that, even though he's one of your friends?
I mean, you know, to not sound biased, but of course that is one of my friends. And, you know, it's a person that I know very well on a level outside of what the media may see. So, of course, you know, outside of the charges that he have come up recently, you know, through the last couple of years, I know the importance of what he has meant to, you know, hip hop and, you know, the community, and also, you know, just the local Atlanta community and things of that nature. And, you know, I think to have someone like T.I. in the position to doing what he's doing, especially facing these charges, is, you know, in a way a blessing in disguise for young voters and for the hip hop generation. And, you know, one of those reasons mainly being it on a surface level, you know, this is the least political hip hop has ever been in its years. You know what I mean? In the last 25 to 30 years on a surface level. So for people of my generation and younger to have somebody like T.I. come to these events, come to the Hip Hop Action Summit Network, and to speak out of the importance of voting and other issues at hand is, you know, a very big deal. Because, you know, when you look at television nowadays and you see a lot of hip hop music videos or a lot of hip hop artists, you know, not a lot of political messages are getting across. So when you have events like this that Russell Simmons and Ben Chavis are putting together and hip hop artists come out, it's very important that, you know, you see their, you know, favorite rappers and artists and things of that nature speaking about the importance. Because, you know, when I was coming up, we had Public Enemy and Poor Righteous Teachers, and I could name a lot that on that level we would see speaking about those things in the music. And now it's like, you know, a lot of these artists, including T.I., are very involved in a lot of sense, but we don't get to see that on that level. So definitely, I think it's an excellent thing that he's in a position to do that.
Biko, how do you think? I mean, I've heard some people say, well, when did we pass the torch to musicians to be political leaders? Now, on the one hand, there have always been people like Harry Belafonte who've taken a strong lead in civil rights issues. But why do you think that music, and not just music, but hip-hop culture, became so prominent as an organizing vehicle for youth politics?
I mean, because it's the patois of the United States. It's our patois. The unfortunate thing is because there hasn't been the baton passing, you know, his name is DJ Drama, and I respect him for that name, but we embrace his warrior culture so that we don't battle our own contradictions. A leader in public needs to battle their contradictions. That's what King was doing. That's what Malcolm X was doing. And what's happened is that these rappers, and, you know, I cut my teeth as a journalist with The Source magazine and have worked in the music industry for the last, you know, 6 years, are put in a situation where they're cut off from their communities once they get signed. And even me and my job, I'm cut off from my community. And they don't feel that everyday pressure of what's going on in the hood. So when they show up, you know, in October, we appreciate and love them. But if we're really going to have change in our community, they have to keep being there. And I don't know where T.I.'s heart is, but if he really believes in changing the community, then he has to keep standing on voter registration and keep being there. But if he doesn't believe in it, you're gonna see his leadership continue to struggle in the mainstream media, because these rappers know what the deal is. They know that they're battling these contradictions, and they know they got that their inner conscience talking to them.
Sonya, let me go to you. You have been a hip-hop journalist. You've covered other things as well, but you have covered Outkast, Ludacris, Lil Jon, T.I. I don't want to make this about any one rapper, but in general, when, you know, we've talked to some rappers who are incredibly politically conscious, maybe not in their rhymes, but on a personal level. So sometimes there's that distinction. But in general, when you talk not just to the artists, but to the fans, how do they perceive the role of hip hop in political activism?
It's interesting that you say that, because I've followed T.I. the past couple of times as he's spoken during his community service with high school, with young people. And people, when you ask Drama the question about, you know, how could he be a spokesperson, well, because people are listening to him and because people are connecting with him. And if it's someone that you can listen to, then you should give them that floor. I mean, he's a very intelligent guy. He connects with the audience, and he's speaking to a lot of the things that I believe in the previous session you talked about, when politicians aren't talking about things that young people are interested in or have going on in their neighborhood, and the musicians are, then they're going to listen to them, and they're going to strike a different chord with them than it will someone who is not saying anything about what's going on in their neighborhood. So to answer your question, I think that in large part because musicians, you know, well, that I think first of all, the young people can differentiate between what they hear on record and who that person is in front of them. I think that, you know, in the same instance that Public Enemy, Chuck D, recently was talking about, he was here for the Red Bull Summit Academy they had here. And to hear him talk about, you know, I think you should vote locally instead of nationally because he doesn't really think that you could have an impact, you know, on the presidential campaign was amazing to me. And he was talking to young people and someone who's often, you know, held up as a force and a voice for political action saying something like that. And it resonated with people because he said people need to be really involved in their neighborhoods, voting for their school boards and that kind of thing. And that's where they feel they can make an impact and see the impact rather than, you know, not that I agree with him, but that was his position.
Well, DJ Drama, you're someone who comes from a family that has a lot of interest in intellectual issues, academic firepower. You mentioned that this is a relatively apolitical time for hip-hop. Why do you think that is?
I can't really say why it is. I mean, I've been listening and part of hip-hop for quite some time, and again, I just think that, you know, in the golden era, which is, you know, the years between 88 and 92, and, you know, what followed that after, you know, Dr. Dre and the Chronic and Gangsta Rap and, you know, what hip-hop has become, I mean, you know, I want to say that a lot of that blame should not go on the artists, you know what I'm saying? I mean, definitely, you know, there was a time when, in a place where, you know, a lot of the music changed and a lot of the political music wasn't supported as much as, you know, gangster rap or quote, what was viewed as gangster rap in that sense. But, you know, again, like I said, like a lot of it, again, is on surface level. And, you know, just using that as an example, I mean, you know, I went to one of the Hip Hop Summit Action Networks that I was a part of, artists like Hurricane Chris, you know, which, you know, has a, in my opinion, kind of a silly song, which is a hit called "A Bay Bay," and to hear this young guy speak, I mean, I was so impressed, you know, to hear the head on his shoulders and, you know, the message that he was giving across. And I think he's like 17 and 18, and this was at Morris Brown College, where a lot of the audience members were college students and everything. So, you know, I mean, I think in music, a lot of things come in cycles and everything. And, you know, we just, you know, there was a party era of hip hop that, you know, was very popular at one time and place. You know what I mean? And dancing is not new in hip hop and it's popular again. So I'm sure that cycle will come back around. But I mean, you know, we also have people like Jay-Z in the positions that he's in, is one of the most prominent figures on Fortune 500, and Russell Simmons, who, you know, put so many things together. So it's a broader scale now. So again, you know, it's political and it's in the bigger scheme of things. I mean, who's to say Russell Simmons is not going to run for some office in one day?
I just want to give a shout, if anyone, we have time for one question, if anyone wants to come to the mic. But meanwhile, if you're just tuning in, we are talking about the hip-hop vote with Sonia Murray, a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, DJ Drama, an Atlanta-based recording artist and DJ, and Rob Biko Baker, executive director of the League of Young Voters. Of course, this is NPR's News and Notes, and I am Farai Chidea. Sonia, let me ask you about gender. Because one of the things that strikes me as a bit of a paradox is that if hip-hop is, as Biko said, the patois of not just black folks, not just young folks, but of, you know, current American pop culture, how can women be solicited into action by hip-hop when hip-hop can be so disrespectful of women?
That's a tough question. I think you kind of have to look broader than hip-hop, the music, and look at hip-hop, the generation, or hip-hop, the culture. I mean, when you look at it that way, you see people of the hip-hop generation, Kerry Washington showing up alongside Usher to support Barack Obama. I mean, they are part of the hip-hop generation. I don't think people who are a part of it see it as narrowly as that. I mean, yes, there are a lot of attacks on women in music, in hip-hop music, I see some really racy country music videos, pop music videos, women are rolling around naked too. I mean, I don't tend to generalize that way. Yes, there are very awful things said about women, awful images of women in all genres of music visually. But I think at the same time, I think that we're smarter than to think that hip-hop is as minute as that. It's just the music. And that I think that, you know, in supporting whomever, you know, for the presidential campaign. We are looking at the issues. We're smarter than that, and we don't really see. I don't really see. I can only speak for myself. I don't really see hip hop. It's just the music, and I'm going to differentiate myself from it because of some things, the bad things that are said in hip hop.
I want to go to a microphone. Please get close to it. Give us your name, where you're from, and your question.
Yes, my name is Shola Lewis, and I'm originally from the Gambia in West Africa, based now in Douglasville, Georgia. And Friar, thanks for coming and joining us here. We definitely enjoy having you. Hip hop to me is two-faced. Call it two-faced because on the one hand, as we just heard a young lady, Miss Murray, just reiterated the fact that, you know, they're saying all kinds of things about women, calling them all kinds of names. And then on the other hand, I'm talking about educating our young folks to vote. I mean, we can't take them seriously. That's number one. I mean, it's making a lot of
money.
When
you say them, who do you mean?
I mean, the hip-hop artists. Because a lot of them really are looking at the funds that they're making, not involved in community activities as they should. But my big thing and a question that I want to ask, don't we think that we have to really rethink and look at society, at our homes, our family values? The most important thing here is we have a lot of single family homes, and therefore the one mom or dad is out there doing 2-3 jobs trying to take care of the family, not having time to spend with the children, and therefore leaving the children to go about do what it is that they want to do, and not going to school, the dropout rate is so high, and we are not able to take control of that. And if we are able to bring the family value, don't you think, by bringing the family together, two family home, we'll be able to control the problem that we have right now among the youths?
I'm going to toss that to you, Biko, and then looks like Drama wants to jump in.
I think, there shouldn't be no surprise that hip-hop is two-faced. Du Bois talked about, you know, the black, the masks, you know, I mean, we double consciousness. We think with both sides of our brain. I'll ask anybody that comes to me and says it's the family, ask them, why is our family like this? This isn't by accident. You know what I'm saying? One thing that you see from the result of the civil rights movement and the black power movement is these crazy policies that get implemented, like the war on drugs, that come in and criminalize our communities. You know what I'm saying? You need to listen to hip-hop. You need to listen to Lil Boosie. You know what I'm saying? You need to listen to these cats who for me, you know, it's hard for me as an older cat in hip-hop to appreciate them because their lyrical skills isn't what it used to be, but they're still telling the truth. And they don't know their mother. They don't know their father. Their father's been in jail. There's 2 million people in jail right now. 50,000 people are going to die a violent death this year from homicide and suicide. These kids don't have any parents, and it's real. And if they do have parents, they're, like you said, working. So if you're not listening to the kids, then we have a real problem because they're the only ones telling the truth.
Let me get Drama in here.
I mean, you know, I think, again, you know, a lot of times hip-hop is always blamed for the ills of, you know, American society and you know, family values being one of those. And again, we do have to remember that it is entertainment, you know, and although I think it is a very powerful tool and, you know, it can be utilized in very powerful ways, I mean, you know, hip-hop artists are not, you know, they don't get on to become the children's role models, although there are situations where they're looked at it. But then again, you know, it's a question I always ask. If Martin Scorsese came out and, you know, has made The Departed and Goodfellas and, you know, all these gangster movies and, you know, and his movies killed thousands of people and sit here and said, I y'all need to vote and, you know, everyone needs to vote and vote for somebody, that's like nobody's going to attack him like they would attack an artist, you know what I'm saying, that may speak on that and on his music and so forth, because at the end of the day, it is still entertainment.
Sonia, we're going to wrap this up with you. How are you doing in terms of covering the hip-hop political events? Are folks coming through Atlanta? Do you see some energy around the hip-hop organizing?
I honestly, in Atlanta, don't. I mean, in terms of just artists who are coming to speak to or rallies or that kind of thing, we hear about the Hip-Hop Summit Action Network, the thing that's happening at Temple University. I haven't really noticed that here in Atlanta yet. At the same time, I know that, you know, whenever the microphone is put in front of a Ludacris or a T.I. or whomever, they are very intelligent in the way that they speak. They're informed about what's happening. And I think that it's not a rally, but it is an informed voice, our voice, you know. And they talk about, in interviews and that kind of thing, what they're doing outside of rapping. what they're doing within their community, what kinds of foundations they're involved in, and the activities that they're participating in. So, no, there's not a rally, but I think they often take the opportunity when they have a microphone in their face to discuss things that are happening within their community and the importance of voting.
Well, I want to thank all three of you. Appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
We were speaking to DJ Drama, an Atlanta-based recording artist and DJ, Sonia Murray, a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Rob Biko Baker, the executive director of the League of Young Voters. They all joined me at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. And you can watch highlights of today's town hall meeting at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.